Welcome to Radio EcoShock, the weekly environment show on CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. This week we have a double treat for you. First, we take you to the Ridge Theater in Vancouver to hear a citizen-organized panel on climate change and what we're going to do about it. Then, a Radio EcoShock special on a speech given last week at the Vancouver Institute by the environmental economist and fossil fuel specialist, Professor Mark Jackard. His topic is Fossil Fuels, Friend or Foe. Many of us think the fossil fuel industry, especially coal, will just be shut down, replaced by wind, solar, and biofuels. Think again. Dr. Jackard predicts fossil fuel use will double during this century. But don't despair. Given good government policy, we can demand that carbon is captured before it reaches the atmosphere and stored deep underground. In our second half hour, you'll get a chance to hear this controversial speaker explain how. But let's start with ways citizens can organize to pressure tardy governments into action to save the climate. This week's event at Vancouver's Ridge Theater was a good example of not waiting for the apocalypse. It was organized by the local New Democratic Party and sponsored by the Ridge Theater and the City of Vancouver. Even the Anglican Church promoted this event. The theater was crammed on the night of February 12th, and more than 200 people had to be turned away. Follow-ups are planned, and I'll tell you about those. For our international listeners, don't go away. Our two panel speakers are Dr. William Rees, the inventor of the concept of the ecological footprint, and a renowned environmental planner. He was preceded by Dr. Phil Austin, a climate and cloud specialist. He gives us the latest since the recent report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Each expert speaks for about 10 minutes. This event is a perfect example of thinking globally and acting locally. If you want to hear the whole event or download talks by specific speakers, all of that is available for free on our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Just look for the Climate Solutions part of our audio on demand menu. Let's go to the Ridge Theater for the event called We Need Some Bright Ideas Now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. My name is Shane Koshalyak, and I'm president of the Vancouver Point Grey NDP, the organizers of this forum on climate change. On behalf of my constituency association, I welcome you to the Ridge Theatre, which is a generous co-sponsor of the forum. Other sponsors include Co-op Books, SPEC, the COPE 378 Union Local, and One Day, representing the City of Vancouver's Office of Sustainability. I thank also the numerous organizations that have advertised the forum on their listservs, particularly the Anglican Church. Point Grey NDP has staged the forum simply because we care about the environment. Environment, of course, is the foundation of quality of life. For several years now, we have tracked climate change as a critical issue. Indeed, the science of global warming has been solid for more than a decade. We have invited nonpartisan speakers because nobody should be deterred by politics from hearing the message, grasping the message that climate change is happening in BC and the world right now. Our first two panelists will inform you about the climate and economic consequences of taking no action. Reversing the effects of global warming will be the work of a generation. Each sector of society, industry, government, and citizens must do its fair share. The following three panelists will tell you what should and can be done in those areas. You've come here tonight to hear bright ideas for the planet now. So without further ado, I introduce to you Heather Harrison, our moderator for the panel, and the question and answer session to follow. Heather is a philosophy instructor at Kwantlen University College, where she teaches environmental ethics, business ethics, and critical thinking. Heather believes the importance of philosophy in a democratic society is that it empowers people to become responsible citizens. Heather has been a political activist for many years and ran in the 2005 Vancouver City election. Currently, she serves on the executives of Vision Vancouver and the provincial NDP. And so I hand it over to you, Heather.
I'm really honored this evening to introduce our panel of distinguished speakers. The first speaker we have this evening is Dr. Philip Austin. Dr. Austin earned his Ph.D. in geophysics from the University of Washington in 1987 and is currently an associate professor in the Department of Earth-Ocean Sciences at UBC, where he serves as an associate chair of the Atmospheric Sciences Program. He also spent a year as a National Research Council postdoctorate fellow in the Climate and Radiation branch of NASA Goddard Space Flight Center before coming to UBC. He's a leader of the Cloud Aerosol Feedbacks and Climate Research Network, which is a four-year collaborative project involving researchers from UBC, McGill, the Université du Québec in Montréal, Dalhousie, and Environment Canada. Dr. Austin will be speaking on the climate effects of global warming. Welcome, Dr. Austin.
So competing with the slideshow that's going to be shown tonight is almost impossible. But what I'd like to do is really take my 10 minutes and talk about two issues that I think we're ready to start a discussion on. As Heather mentioned, or Sean mentioned, the debate's been over on why climate is warming for about 10 years or so now. And for whatever reason, this movie is perhaps a big part of this. The problem really now has tipped, and I think we're looking at the next phase, which is to try and figure out what to do about it. And so before we do that, I think it's worthwhile looking a little bit at the science and asking a couple questions. And the two I want to cover in the 10 minutes that I've got are essentially this idea of dangerous interference, because this is going to be a topic that's going to be in conversations for the next 75 to 100 years, I think, as we try and avoid a warming of 2 degrees. And I just want to say a little bit about where that number comes from and why it would be prudent to try and keep the global temperature to within 2 degrees of what it was pre-industrial. And then the second is, I think a lot of people, even if they are now sold on the idea that we actually are causing the warming that's observed, really, this is a legitimate question. How can we predict temperatures in the year 2100 when we can't tell you whether it's going to rain next Friday? And so this I think, is going to be a topic also for the next 50 to 100 years as we try and actually make regional forecasts in a changing environment. So for the next several centuries, no matter what we do right now, things are going to be changing, and we can control the throttle. We can certainly change the rate of change, but we're going to be grappling with a world that one decade to the next is a little bit different. And the models are going to be able to tell us some things and not others. And in particular, I'd like to introduce this idea of climate sensitivity, because this is the crucial thing that we need to know working forward in the next 30 years or so. So could I have the next slide? So this is this idea of dangerous interference. And really, to put this in perspective, you need to really look at the last 5 million years of climate. And so what we've got here is a sediment core going from 5.5 million years ago to the present. And you can see that 5 million years ago, it was 2 degrees warmer than it is currently. There was no ice in the Arctic. The Arctic Ocean was open. And there was no ice in Greenland, so that the sea level was 75 meters higher than it is currently. As the orbit of the Earth changed, the sunlight in the northern hemisphere decreased until at about 3 million years ago, the Arctic froze and the Greenland ice sheet formed very rapidly. And at that point, then, you have this the beginning of the ice ages and this large oscillation between ice sheets that covered all the way down to 35 degrees latitude, and a planet that was about the same temperature as it is currently. So 2 degrees is a significant amount of warming. 2 degrees is the difference between ice-free pole and an ice-free Greenland and the world that we actually know. So if I could then focus on the next slide, which shows the last 500,000 years, and we know we've now moved this back to 650,000 years. This is the center point of inconvenient truth, and from a climate scientist point of view, a huge contribution of this movie is the fact that Al Gore really walks you through this slide, and this is the CO2 record here in green, this is the temperature record in blue, and you don't have to be a climate scientist to, as Al Gore says, to think that these things are connected. And in fact, you can actually use the ice ages to investigate whether your model is working or not. And we can use the ice ages to determine the climate sensitivity. So what we really want to know from the climate models is, if we do double CO2, how much will the surface temperature increase? Will it increase 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 6 degrees? And again, 2 degrees and 3 degrees is the difference between an ice-free pole and a pole that actually has relatively normal sea levels. So if I could have the next slide. So this is the CO2 and the temperature record together, and you can see that they trend almost identically. And again, I don't think you could make this point often enough, which is that this is the present. Here's the last interglacial. This is a sea level that is 4 to 6 meters higher than it is at present, and this is about the same temperature as it is today, actually. And we had 280 parts per million of CO2 at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Today, we're actually beyond 370. We're at 380. There's probably no way we're going to stop below 450 parts per million. And if we burn coal, there's nothing stopping us really from hitting 1,000 parts per million. And so every time we double CO2, we actually double the problem, because the warming is, every time you double the concentration, you actually double the warming. So again, the take-home point from here is that 2 degrees is really a large amount of warming, and we're going to have to stop the CO2 concentrations before it gets much beyond current levels. And so the question is, how much? And if I could have the next slide. Now, this is from a very recent climate model run. This is the Goddard Institute for Space Sciences, coupled GCM, one of the best. And this addresses my second point, which is, if you can't predict the weather for longer than 2 weeks, which you can't, it's impossible, how can you predict the climate in the year 2100? And you can see that climate is different from weather. These are 5 runs of the Goddard model, and there's no butterfly effect, right? The runs stay together, and that's because climate is fundamentally predictable, because it's forced on these long time scales. So this is 1880, this is 2000, and all 5 of these runs actually do an excellent job of predicting the current or the history of the surface temperature of the planet. So we're at the point now where we actually have capable models, and we can start asking them questions. And on this slide are all the different ways that we actually heat and cool the planet. The line here is the greenhouse warming. These spikes are volcanic eruptions. This is Pinatubo, and this is El Chichon, and this is Krakatoa. And again, each of these can be used to calibrate the model. But an ironic point is that we aren't feeling the full effect of the greenhouse gases that we've actually put into the atmosphere. First of all, because about half the heat has actually gone into the ocean. And we've got a pretty good handle on this now, and it's waiting to come out. So this is this idea that even if we were able to magically turn CO2 off tomorrow, you aren't able to actually stop the warming. It'll come out through the oceans. But the other thing is that pollution here is doing an extraordinarily good job of cooling us off. And as we put stack scrubbers in, for example, in the coal-fired power plants, we're going to eliminate this cooling. and then that's going to actually make the greenhouse effect probably twice as bad. So the bottom line is that in this model, if you double CO2, you increase the surface temperature by 3 degrees, and that actually is not good. So that's more than 2 degrees. So my final slide then is this one. So this is from the most recent IPCC report, and here you've got three different scenarios for the future. The red one here is what I call letter rip, which is 15 billion people with sort of economic efficiencies of about today, burning everything they could get their hands on. So that's the red line here, and you can see on this trajectory at 2100, we are well above 4 degrees. So probably we lose the Greenland ice sheet in about 200 years. There is the business as usual, which is right here. But this is a trajectory called B2, a set of economic choices that we can make that actually stabilize the warming below 2 degrees. And so I'm sure the other speakers will talk more about this. I can address the spread in the models here, but my take-home point here is that there is actually a way to stabilize climate at 2 degrees. So if we have the will, then certainly the models indicate that a solution's possible.
Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Bill Rees. Dr. Rees earned his PhD in population ecology from the University of Toronto and has taught at the University of British Columbia School of Community and Regional Planning since 1970, where he teaches the ecological basis for human development. He is the originator of the ecological footprint analysis and a founding member of the Canadian Society for Ecological Economics. The Vancouver Sun has described Dr. Rees as one of BC's top public intellectuals. And last year, Dr. Rees was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Dr. Bill Rees will be speaking on the economic effects of climate change. Welcome, Dr. Rees.
Thank you very much, Heather. I'm actually going to talk mostly about something called the Stern Report, which some of you will know was an economic report to the British government released on October 30th of last year. This report is one of a string of reports from economists. If we can go to the next slide, please. It really starts from the basic science. In fact, there's no new science whatsoever in the Stern Report. And I'm going to sound a little bit cynical here, because despite the fact that there's no new science here, until the recent IPCC report, the Stern Report seems to have been more effective in waking people up to the reality of the problem, because it's money-based, than any of the science preceding. But just because it's an economist talking here doesn't mean there's any absolute truth in what Stern has to say. So I want to move back about a decade or more to what some previous economists have had to say about climate change. If we can move forward, please. Here are three quotes, all from very well-known papers from very prominent economists on climate change. They all have two things in common. The first is the totally incorrect assumption that agriculture is the only sector of the economy likely to be affected. The second is they agree that agriculture is only about 3% of gross domestic product, or gross world product, in fact. Now, when we look at that, look at the middle quote, because it really captures what the others two do as well. Since agriculture is only 3% of GDP, even if net output of agriculture falls by 50%, this is only a 1.5% cut in gross domestic product, in this case in Britain. The same is true in Canada or the United States. Notice the ludicrous assumption here that the world could sustain a loss of half of its food production when 2 billion people are already malnourished, and the only impact would be a 1.5% hit in GDP per capita. The Nordhaus quote preceding that makes exactly the same point and is an extremely influential economic report that has really shaped U.S. climate change. So we have to be a little bit careful in understanding what these earlier reports said, and it helps to shape our reaction to Stern. If we can go to the next slide. Well, we've already had some of these statistics. We know the present concentration of greenhouse, or the pre-industrial concentration. We know the present concentration in terms of carbon dioxide equivalents in parts per million. The main point is the middle bullet here. With likely increasing accelerating emissions, we could reach 550 parts per million CO2 equivalent by as early as 2035, which would bring a 77% chance of exceeding the 2 degree Celsius maximum temperature rise that Philip has indicated is really an extremely important number to keep in mind. A 77% chance of meeting this disastrous level of warming by just about 30 years from now. If we go to the next slide, please. Here are some of the impacts that Stern admits are likely to result from a slightly increased temperature beyond that 2 degree limit, which he says is probable, or at least likely. Major declines in crop yields over entire regions. Sea level rise threatening London, Shanghai, New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Richmond, Cairo, and areas inhabited by 5% of the world's people. We will see refugees, about 350 million, if we take 5% of the 7 billion population that's likely to be on the planet by 2035. There was an article just last week in the Vancouver Sun showing that the RCMP are already looking at the consequences for Canada of having to deal with a huge increase in the number of immigrants. The collapse of the Amazon rainforest, possible collapse of the Gulf Stream, collapse of all the world's major glaciers and major flood risk. We've already heard about that with the rise in sea level. A loss of up to 40% of the world's species, major health epidemics, and so on. This is a short list of the likely consequences of a likely scenario over the next, the rest of this century. What he concludes in the end is extremely important and vastly different from the conclusions of the previous economics reports that have had so much influence on policy just in the last decade. His minimal projection is that allowing things to proceed business as usual, the scenario we saw a moment ago, would result in as much as a 20% loss of GDP, much greater than the 1.5%, a minimal loss of GDP on the order of 5% is possible. He argues that with only 1% of GDP invested each year, the world can avoid these huger costs, and therefore the bottom line is that reducing the expected adverse impacts of climate change is both highly desirable and feasible. Tell that to our present government, who are not willing to spend a dime really on doing what is necessary to make the deep cuts necessary here. The other point I want to make is that the whole the numbers in the Stern report, I won't even get into them because they're extremely suspect in the sense that one of the most difficult things to do is to estimate the real value of ecological impacts and intangibles in an increasingly chaotic world where we can't really well predict what the consequences are likely to be. Next slide, please. This is the really important one from the perspective of everyone in this room. To stabilize atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations at between 500 and 550 parts per million, that's the level at which, beyond which more than 2 degree increase in temperature can be expected, will require a more than an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Everything we do, about 85 to 90% of the energy basis of techno-industrial society is currently derived from fossil fuels. In the next 35 to 50 years, we must abandon 80% or more of the fossil fuels we use to power our economies. And as a somewhat student of alternative energy, I can say that in total, the current technologies available to us as substitutes won't come close to replacing the dramatic decline in fossil fuels that we must begin enter into if we're going to achieve the necessary target. In the short term, we must see a CO2 emissions peak within the next decade or so, highly unlikely given the trajectory that China and India are on. China brings a new power plant capable of powering a city the size of Vancouver every week to 10 days. And this is primitive coal-fired power technology because we won't sell them the technology necessary to make it clean technology. Talk about shooting ourselves in the foot. Recommended actions. Next slide, please. Here I think the report really gets soft because there's nothing here that we haven't heard 10,000 times before, and even here in these soft recommendations, not much is happening. We must reduce demand for emission-intensive goods and services. In other words, shift consumer behavior. Instruments here should include carbon taxes. The fact of the matter is that people respond to price increases. The only time in the history of humanity that per capita energy declined for a period of several years was between 1978, roughly, and 1983, and that was the period during the Arab oil embargo and the Iran war, during which time real prices rose for fossil fuels to higher levels than we're experiencing today. The effect was a dramatic decrease in per capita and therefore gross energy consumption. Notice the world did not fall apart. The result was the invention of the Honda Civic and other efficient technologies. Canada took the world lead in wind power technology. We quickly drop it as soon as oil prices return to quote-unquote normal, which means energy consumption once again began to go up. The main point is that every political party in Canada has sworn, now I may be wrong about the NDP on this one, but certainly both the Liberals and Conservatives have said, never will we have a carbon tax or resource depletion taxes in this country. That's precisely the most powerful tool in the current kit box of tools that would help us to reduce our carbon emissions. Let's move to the next slide very quickly. There has been a number of very strongly worded reactions to the Stern report. In general, there is concurrence, if reluctant concurrence. But the Stern report still hasn't dispelled deep denial. The Cato Institute in Washington, the American Enterprise Institute, are both dead set against it. In the case of the Cato Institute, they claim that the Stern report flies in the face of academic literature on the subject, which finds that climate change would have only a moderately negative impact at best. There are as many economic gains associated with warming as there are economic costs. The American Enterprise Institute, very closely tied to the Cato Institute, has just been given a major award by the petroleum industry in the United States to pay scientists $10,000 to come forward to discredit the IPCC report and therefore the Stern document. My final slide is about our money-obsessed society. This is where my cynicism comes in here. It's interesting to me that scientists have been warning us for decades about the impending problem. Here's one from 1992 from the Union of Concerned Scientists. We, the undersigned senior members of the world scientific community, hereby warn all humanity of what lies ahead. A great change in our stewardship of the earth and of the life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated. That kind of warning has been repeated for a decade or more now with increasingly strident tones and falls on deaf ears, hardly reported in the newspapers. But as soon as somebody puts a money price on this, it's not good enough that we destroy the planet. But if we know that it costs several to several tens of trillions of dollars, then we pay attention. There's something wrong, it seems to me, with our value system when we only respond to the money charge. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to speeches from the event We Need Some Bright Ideas Now, organized by the Point Grey New Democratic Party, held February 12, 2007, at the Ridge Theater in Vancouver. If you missed this event, you can download the whole thing from www.ecoshock.org. Look for our Climate Solutions section from our Audio On Demand menu. Better yet, get active yourself. Lots of people are very concerned about our climate future. Here is NDP Point Grey President Shane Kosielniak announcing upcoming climate events here in Vancouver.
The Sierra Club is organizing a climate change Climate Crisis Film Festival at the downtown branch of the Vancouver Public Library System. That's running the 21st, the 22nd, and the 24th of February, with screenings starting at 6 p.m. I'm pleased to be able to announce that Vancouver Fairview NDP will host a copycat of this forum at the Park Theatre on Cambie Street in the first week of March. We'll be posting details of that on the GW Forum website, and of course we'll notify everyone that was on our waitlist for this event, which is about 200 people. Breaking news, Van City has an event again here at the Ridge, March the 8th, and some of you may know, in fact, that one of Van City's CEOs, Steve Mowat, took the Al Gore boot camp and is prepared to basically give the Al Gore slideshow. So he'll be doing that here March 8th.
You are listening to Activist Media, Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. I urge you to support this show and this station by becoming a member of Co-op Radio. It turns out we really need an independent media to cover climate change. No car advertising here, no oil companies to satisfy. To become a member, just call 604-684-8494. Please tell them you support Radio EcoShock. That helps us stay on the air. The number again is 684-8494. As you may have heard, the Premier of British Columbia, Gordon Campbell, has now said the two new coal plants proposed by BC Hydro will have to implement 100% carbon capture and storage or not open at all. This is a huge victory for our environment. The old-style coal plants would have doubled the greenhouse gases emitted for electricity production in this province. Campbell has also called for California-style emissions regulations for cars. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has welcomed a new pollution control partner on the West Coast and says he will visit British Columbia this summer to meet with the Premier. This is a near total about-face for Premier Campbell, who previously downplayed both climate change and the need for action. He promises to make BC the first carbon-neutral government in North America, and he says we'll reduce the province's greenhouse gas emissions by at least 33% below the current levels by 2030. However, in a television news interview, the Premier doesn't plan any new legislation to make this happen. Stay tuned. We'll be covering Campbell's plan in more detail next week. Campbell said his new climate action team will, quote, demand two proposed coal-fired plants pump 100% of their emissions into the ground. According to Professor Mark Jackard, that's what we need to hear around the world. And Dr. Jackard thinks we need to be much more realistic about our energy strategy for the future. We were lucky enough to get a recording of his speech at the Vancouver Institute on February 10, 2007. Our thanks to the Vancouver Institute, and you can Google them to get their impressive list of upcoming speakers. There isn't time to give you the full one-hour speech. You can get that from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Meanwhile, here is our take on fossil fuels, friend or foe.
Open a power plant, open your wallet. The future rains success on global warming.
So here's a scenario in which fossil fuels, we end up using almost twice as much fossil fuels 100 years from now in our global energy system.
Sky is a landfill.
The costs of using fossil fuels cleanly into the next century look like they're going to be equal to or cheaper than the alternatives.
Professor Mark Jackard predicts a strong future for fossil fuels. He says their use will only rise despite fears of climate change. We may not be doomed, though. The carbon dioxide could be trapped and put back into the ground. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I don't like what Mark Jackard is telling us about the continuing future for fossil fuels. But that doesn't mean he isn't right. I don't like what climate scientists are predicting for my kids' futures either, but I listen to them. We're going to examine why fossil fuels may continue to coexist with renewables and how we can survive a world energy system three times its current size.
So I think nuclear power will grow in the global energy system, but not enough to take over for fossil fuels, which are currently 85% of that system. Efficiency has its limits that I talked about, and especially I just talked about our challenges in a wealthy country to make energy efficiency happen. Think of the developing world. Someone in a village in India is using about 1 gigajoule per person per year, whereas in Canada we're using 300, 320. So even when I have them not getting close to us, and I have us going down, and I have them coming up to 200 or 100, I should say, gigajoules, you have a global energy system that's 2-3 times larger 100 years from now. So that has to be almost a zero-emission energy system. It's going to have to be nuclear or renewables or zero-emission fossil fuels. And so I find that the biggest competition over the next 100 years will probably be between renewables and fossil fuels. And surprisingly to my title, I think renewables are winning over time, but it's going to take a very long time, and it could take hundreds of years. And so I have a scenario, which I'll show you, in which sort of the culmination of the book is this scenario right here, the global energy system in the year 2000 and 2100. And what you see is that renewables, fossil fuels have grown about four times larger. Nuclear is about four times larger. I've got renewables traditional, that's the TRAD, and renewable modern. Traditional is just still burning biomass. Renewables modern are, it could be biomass, but used in gasification processes and so on, or, you know, making biodiesel and ethanol, and also, of course, wind power and solar power. And you see that renewables grow at a tremendous rate throughout the century. But the global energy system is three times larger. So here's a scenario in which fossil fuels, we end up using almost twice as much fossil fuels 100 years from now in our global energy system. But this is an energy system that only puts out about, at the very bottom line there, 1 to 2 gigatons of carbon. And that's a system that's getting, that has transitioned over the 100 years to where the scientists say we need to go in terms of greenhouse gases. And finally, I have an overhead that I won't show. I compare that in terms of cost and other factors to a system in which we do what David Goodstein said in the quote that I had at the beginning. We try to abolish fossil fuels in the span of this century.
Mark Jacquard graduated from Simon Fraser University. He is an environmental economist. He was chair and CEO of the British Columbia Utilities Commission for 5 years in the 1990s. From 1993 to 96, Dr. Jacquard contributed to the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has advised the Chinese government and large industry on energy policy. He has also co-authored 2 books on climate policy, including the 2005 book Sustainable Fossil Fuels. On February 10, 2007, Mark Jacquard spoke at the University of British Columbia as part of the Vancouver Institute series. The complete speech is available from Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. His topic was Fossil Fuels, Friend or Foe? So, what is the fuss? Contrary to many leading green thinkers, Jacquard doesn't think energy conservation is the place to start. If we are concerned about the environment, he claims we begin with emissions control. After all, he says, if we didn't use the environment for free dumping ground for carbon waste, fossil fuels would continue as the best source of condensed solar energy on the planet.
So the issues with energy efficiency also are, if you do push energy efficiency, you're actually improving the productivity of these technologies, light bulbs and so on. And as people's incomes go up, do they innovate new ways of using those technologies? You just think, BC Hydro thinks, great, we've got them using efficient light bulbs at Christmas. Well, just watch what's happening now at Halloween. Now everyone's putting lights up at Halloween. Next, it'll be Easter. So humans are, and I'm not condoning this, but I want to be real realistic if I'm interested in saving the planet. So we have to be hard-nosed about what the research is showing us.
Jacquard also contradicts the peak oil movement, saying we aren't going to run out of oil or coal anytime soon, and certainly not soon enough to save the climate. He points to existing technologies to retrieve so-called heavy oil from many parts of the world, including Canada's tar sands. And there's at least 250 years' worth of coal left, if not more, and we can make oil from that if we want to.
With respect to Hubert's Peak, that graph that I showed you earlier of the oil from different parts of the country, that was conventional oil. That was not Alberta oil sands oil. It was not Venezuela heavy oil. It was not unconventional. It wasn't gas. That was just an oil peak. The total fossil fuel resource is really large. Obviously, we're on a finite planet. It's still a finite resource, but it's really large. And so if we think that running out of it is going to save us, guess again. And we're kind of learning that as we thought, wow, we're running out of oil. Some people thought, great. And now you see Alberta oil sands expanding at a rapid pace. And similar things like that happening around the world. We're in Canada, so we notice what's going on in Alberta.
Finally, he says, installing emission controls to capture and store carbon dioxide is cheaper than retooling modern civilization to use alternative energy. Is this just another oil industry stooge? Not really. Jacquard says he doesn't receive a dime from the fossil fuel industry. In fact, as a young graduate student, he started out with the common assumption we would phase out fossil fuels within a generation. But as an academic, he questioned everything, including his own views, and ended up with a very different point of view.
So we're worried about the cleanliness, and we're worried about the endurance. How long can they last? They're a non-renewable resource. So those are the two conventional elements of conventional wisdom that I wanted to look at as a researcher and open my mind to. And I especially was interested in doing that because I'm someone who, from the time I was a grad student, I believed that the path to a sustainable energy system had to involve the phasing out of fossil fuels, and that I would see significant progress in that direction during my career. And so that I wouldn't be surprised at some of the books that come out, and that have especially come out in the last few years. And I'll just list you some of the titles. Long Emergency, The Party's Over, Peak Oil, Hubert's Peak, End of Oil, End of the Age of Oil, End of the Era of Oil, End of the Days of Oil. And you can see they're having trouble with the original titles here. And it goes on. And just to pick one is David Goodstein, who was the provost of science at California Polytechnic, in his book End of the Age of Oil with Norton. The last sentence of the book says, civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century unless we can find a way to live without fossil fuels.
Let's give him a fair hearing. After all, the future may not turn out the way we expect. First of all, let's look at why fossil fuels may not run out in time to save us from climate change. Although oil becomes more difficult to retrieve, fossil fuels may not become expensive enough to drive a conversion to alternative sources like wind or nuclear. We'll go to tar sands, he says, or even making oil from coal.
There are other ways of producing those kinds of fuels or synthetic versions of them. Of course, we can use biomass, as the Brazilians make about 40% of the fuel for their vehicles from ethanol from sugarcane. But also, just looking at fossil fuels, you could make synthetic gasoline and diesel from coal. And this is with technologies that existed since the 1920s. And in fact, near the end of the Second World War, Germany, something like 85% of its economy and its armaments were running on synthetic gasoline diesel products that were made from coal. And today in South Africa, that's how about 50% of their gasoline and diesels are produced. And what's the cost? You could build a new plant today with water recovery systems, full water treatment, land rehabilitation, and it would be profitable as long as the international price of oil was above $30 or $40 a barrel.
Jacquard doesn't rate energy conservation very highly. As head of the BC Utilities Commission in the 1990s, he ordered a conservation program, but found the consumer behavior frustrated many of these efforts. For example, the utility offered discounts on new, more energy-efficient refrigerators, but didn't reclaim the old ones. Some people just put the old fridge in the basement to cool drinks, and so now they had two. Similarly, he finds many people have energy-saving compact fluorescent light bulbs in a drawer because they don't like the quality of the light, which they associate with offices or hospitals. Jacquard also looked into why people buy cars. Personal mobility was just part of the picture. Identification of social status and even expression of male sexuality was also a factor in buying gas guzzlers. So the mere logic of energy efficiency may not be enough to overcome the illogic and emotions that drive consumer choice in the real world. Jacquard believes the free market system is better than the alternatives. He is a fellow of the conservative C.D. Howe Institute and advises large corporations. And yet, here he is calling for massive government action to regulate carbon emissions in order to save the climate. In his speech, it seems to me Jacquard downplays some of the benefits of real energy conservation. Friends, we don't know what real energy conservation looks like, especially for consumers. People assume it is their right to buy a propane heater for the backyard, essentially to heat the outdoors and then throw the carbon up the stack. It's our right to drive wherever we want, even tremendous distances, just for the fun of it. And we can choose to do it in a vehicle that gets 8 miles to the gallon. It's just as legal to put up 100,000 Christmas tree lights on the house. We haven't seen energy conservation yet here. All this craziness would disappear with carbon rationing, which is not part of Jacquard's prescription. Does he prefer to operate as a realist in a consumer choice system, even if the climate goes to hell? Not really. Jacquard seems sincere in his concern about our future, even though he doesn't call himself an environmentalist. He just thinks that policy needs to be based on real human behavior. The future may not be radically different from the past. Humans will likely insist on driving around and using lots of energy. In fact, as more of humanity moves from a rural, low-energy lifestyle to cities, Jacquard predicts the total world energy system will at least triple in size. In this three-times energy world of 2100, renewable energy may have grown several hundred times its current size, but fossil fuels may also double or more. That spells disaster unless we can enforce clean fossil fuel technology. Jacquard's research, outlined in his book Sustainable Fossil Fuels, finds that we can still use oil or coal to generate electricity and provide that power for public transportation, provided the carbon dioxide is captured and returned either to the ground or to the very deep ocean. He has studied the costs of using existing pipelines and drilling expertise, as well as building whole new networks of pipelines and underground storage facilities. Jacquard reports even this huge addition to the fossil fuel system is cheaper and easier to implement than trying to shut down the whole fossil fuel system to be replaced by renewables or nuclear. He says we should go with what we know now and what we are already doing, but just modify the system to capture greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, what about looking at the hypothesis of using fossil fuels cleanly? Again, I was quite surprised. You can take natural gas, coal, oil, you can convert them into secondary forms of energy, remember that I was talking about, electricity or hydrogen, for example, and then at the same time, so that's a clean form of secondary energy. When we use it, we're not going to have emissions, and at the same time, take all the byproducts that you're not interested in and extract those, and then perhaps store them somewhere. Now, there are big questions about this, right? What does it cost to extract them? What kind of impacts are done when you make that conversion? What about where do you store it? And so on. And now I'm going to touch briefly on that, and I wouldn't be surprised if you have more questions about that. And that's something I explore in a great amount of detail in the book. But just to give you a sense of that, the most simple diagram I can make, I'll focus on carbon dioxide. What would you do as you extracted the carbon dioxide? So think of a process where we're taking natural gas, coal, oil. We might be gasifying it. You could actually just burn the coal. And just as in a coal plant today, a modern coal plant, we would capture particulates, ash and stuff that's coming out. We capture sulfur dioxide with a desulfurization process. And we can also capture the carbon dioxide by getting it into a chemical reaction. And so then the question is, what do you do with the carbon dioxide? Well, because of enhanced oil recovery, for one thing, we have thousands of kilometers of carbon dioxide pipelines in North America. And we've been pumping carbon dioxide into the ground for decades. So there again, we have experience with all of the technologies that are necessary. If you weren't putting it in old oil and gas reservoirs, you might put it in deep saline aquifers.
But is there really room in the earth to store all our carbon waste?
But what I want to show you is that if you look at the oil and gas reservoirs, that's sort of in the middle, they're the cheapest place to put this because we're willing to pay to do that because we get a value from the carbon dioxide. It helps us to recover more oil, which has money. But eventually, if we're to keep using fossil fuels, we'd have to look at the saline aquifers, and they're everywhere in sedimentary basins. These are deep aquifers, 900 to 1,500 meters under the surface of the earth or under the floor of the ocean. And, for example, we actually already use aquifers for storage. In Alberta, You know, in Vancouver we have that pile, or we always had that yellow pile, I haven't looked lately, of sulfur in the harbor, because you weren't allowed to just let the sulfur in, sulfurous natural gas that you found, get out into the air, and you want to get the sulfur level down so that we can use it commercially. And so they have sulfur extraction techniques, and in fact they get a lot of carbon dioxide with that as well. And so what they've been doing in Alberta for some time now is pumping this into saline aquifers. In fact, there are 52 sites of this in Alberta today, and some of these are 95% carbon dioxide, so that we're already pumping carbon dioxide into deep aquifers. And the Norwegians are also doing a project, and actually there are several that are happening right now. So when you're talking carbon capture and storage, 90% of the cost is that process of extracting the carbon in the plant, converting coal into hydrogen. You know, 10%, 15% of the cost is transporting the carbon and injecting it into the ground. So that's quite cheap.
Again, there is a real worry that Jacquard is giving permission for the oil and coal companies to keep on producing deadly carbon fuels under the cover of a future solution. At some point, I hope to discuss that problem with him. You're listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Professor Jacquard gives a fascinating, if poignant, example in his dealings with Bangladesh. That government is only too aware that large parts of this densely populated and poor country may go underwater in the future due to rising seas driven by burning fossil fuels in other countries. Yet Bangladesh needs power urgently and has discovered gas fields off its coast in the Bay of Bengal. Can this poor country install the expensive new alternative technologies, such as wind or tidal energy? Should Bangladesh develop and use its natural gas, thus adding to its own doom? Here is what Jacquard says about it.
I've advised the government in Bangladesh before. Bangladesh has all this natural gas under the Bay of Bengal. So they could not touch the natural gas and just try to work with the renewables they have. Their renewables are quite expensive. They're going to be a challenge for them. And so if they forego the natural gas, the cost, even this is natural gas where they would take the natural gas, get the carbon dioxide out of it and put it back under the Bay of Bengal, in the scenario where they don't touch the natural gas, it's much more expensive for them. So I equate that into schools, hospitals, dikes, other aspects of infrastructure that they would have to forego because they decided to forego the cheaper zero-emission fossil fuels. So those are the kinds of real trade-offs that people will have to make in different parts of the world.
Jacquard says people who care about the climate should all have a 5-year ban on saying the word Kyoto Protocol. That agreement, he says, could never work for at least two reasons. One, it was unrealistic given consumer preferences and international development. Many countries, like Canada, agreed to targets and came out with high-sounding plans one after another, but then went on to pollute more and more. Secondly, Kyoto was never an international agreement, he says. It was really just Europe, Canada, and Japan. Countries like China and India only signed on because they didn't have to do anything. They were exempted as developing countries. Jacquard now thinks Kyoto should be junked, and a whole new, really workable international agreement is necessary. Even while those negotiations go on, he says, developed countries need to take leadership roles by implementing one or two solutions. Either legislate a cap-and-trade system for carbon, or impose a carbon tax. Both systems will work, he says, given tough national legislation. In addition to banning the words Kyoto Protocol, Jacquard leaves us with three final conclusions. First, when politicians talk about targets for emissions, forget it. Targets mean nothing without a real cap, a limit on greenhouse gas emissions. Second, policies calling for voluntary action by industry or consumers haven't worked and will not work. They didn't work in George Bush's Texas or in the United States. That is just a smokescreen for continued pollution of the atmosphere while talking green.
Forget about the non-compulsory policies. We have to have policies that either constrain us by regulation from using the atmosphere or financially penalize us. In other words, if we don't want people to drive fast in school zones, we either have to have a regulation that, and we know that ethically we all, a lot of us would, just with those signs, drive slowly in school zones, and nonetheless, we put in a regulation that says we'll take away your license if you do it to, well, first of all, we'll give you a financial penalty. We'll fine you, but eventually, if you do it enough times, we'll take away your license as well. So, a regulatory constraint or a financial penalty.
Finally, as he said all along, don't count out fossil fuels as a continuing mainstay of the world energy system. But if we want to keep on living in a climate as known to our ancestors, we must fiercely regulate all emissions into the atmosphere.
If the end that we're looking for is a clean, enduring, and low-cost energy system, that we should be careful to assume a priori that fossil fuels are an enemy. And in fact, they may very well be a friend. But first, for any of that to happen, we have to get the policies right. And those policies have to prevent us by regulation or financial penalty from using the atmosphere as a free waste receptacle. And if a politician tells you, I don't believe in nasty greenhouse gas taxes or regulating people, what they are really telling you is that we're not going to reduce greenhouse gases. And so your responsibility, when people all say, I hear politicians also saying, change your lifestyle. You need to change your lifestyle. What I end up saying is, wait a minute, how did people change their lifestyles to reduce acid emissions or lead coming out of tailpipes or nitrous oxide emissions or particulates? What we did is we got good public policy that regulated manufacturers and industry and what it did and manufacturers in the products that it allowed us to choose. Or it charged us money for the using the atmosphere, as I talked about. Those things are what we have to do, and we have to do them very urgently. Thank you very much for your attention.
After the speech, I asked Dr. Jacquard a couple of questions. First, what did he think of Richard Branson's $25 million quest to find technology to remove existing carbon from the air? What do you think of Richard Branson's effort to call for taking carbon back out of the air that's already there?
Oh, yes. That's why when I hear people saying, uh-oh, we're in big trouble because we've already put all this carbon in there, and so we're going to have to wait hundreds of years for it to slowly dissipate out into oceans and biomass, that's not quite true. I mean, we already, when I talk about those gasification processes, already today where trees are growing, just like coal, we can gasify the trees, and in fact people are talking about building these biomass slash coal plants and then sequestering the CO2. Well, that's a reverse process. That's a true offset, because then you're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it back underground. So that one we're technologically capable of doing right now, and the cost would not be that high. When there's other work going on, these kinds of machines. A colleague of mine in Calgary is working on one of these. He has this huge hangar where, you know, you're pumping air through and you can actually extract carbon from the air. But so far, those use a lot of energy. And so I don't know if they'll get a breakthrough there.
And then, in the end, we did agree that despite our current market system, humans could agree to make big changes to save the world. You've suggested that we can't really have a big change in society to achieve these goals, but if we are really threatened by climate change, possibly even with extinction, couldn't we at least rise to the level that we did at World War II, where everyone was aimed on the same page and in the same direction, and they made big changes and they made big sacrifices to defeat a threat?
Yep. And what they did is they brought in rations. So that's a regulation. They brought in conscription. They did all sorts of, they didn't say, okay, let's voluntarily just deal with this. Who wants to go and help? They said, hey, you know what? We're all in it together. We got to have laws and rules that make it for everyone, and that's all I'm saying.
I agree, but my point is that such a big change is possible in society if we want it enough, isn't it?
Yes. That's the point that I'm trying to make in my book, that here's the path. Then I'm just trying to say, okay, if humanity goes after it, don't assume that that path is going to look like this in terms of the energy options. Don't assume the path is going to look like this in terms of policy options, for sure. So I'm not a fossil fuel advocate, and I'm not even sure if fossil fuels will hang on. But I just, when I tried to independently sort of just take away my bias towards renewables and so on and just look at the evidence, I was kind of surprised at where it drove me.
Find out more about the book Sustainable Fossil Fuels at the website of the Energy and Materials Research Group, www.emrg.sfu.ca, emrg.sfu.ca. Clips in this report came from a speech presented by the Vancouver Institute on February 10, 2007, recorded by David Gold and edited by Radio EcoShock. Find Professor Mark Chikard's full speech and further discussion free in the Energy section of www.ecoshock.org. This is your host, Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to Radio EcoShock. Join us next Friday and every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM or listen over the internet at www.cooperadio.org. The show is also available on cable throughout British Columbia and by satellite on Star Choice Channel 845. Remember, when we wake up from the nightmare, we can make a better world.